All of us, when we come to read the Bible by ourselves or in a study group, are carrying with us approaches to the Bible that have been developed in the history of the church. And if we don't have some consciousness of how that has developed, we really don't understand ourselves or the ways in which we have been influenced, and therefore don't have much self-consciousness. But the study of history is one way in which we can be sensitized to the ways in which we've been influenced by our culture.
Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the White Horse Inn. We have the pleasure of having in studio a guest you have heard many times. It's hardly appropriate to call him a guest, the president and professor of church history at Westminster Seminary, California, Dr. W. Robert Godfrey. He's the author of An Unexpected Journey, Reformation Sketches, and John Calvin, Pilgrim and Pastor, as well as other works. He not only teaches church history, he was there at many of the events where they occurred. And so it's a real pleasure to have you on the White Horse Inn once again, Dr. Godfrey.
I'm beginning to wish that I was a guest, because then I'd be treated better.
Okay, first of all, we're trying to get people interested in church history here.
Why? I've been trying to do that for decades. It's a vain enterprise, but go ahead.
Give it your best shot. Why is it important to study church history?
It's important to study church history because church history reminds us that we live 2,000 years after the New Testament, and that there are things that have happened in those 2,000 years. And much of what has happened in that period actually has an impact on us as individual believers in the 21st century, on our congregations, on our denominations. And if we don't have some consciousness of how that has developed, we really don't understand ourselves or understand the ways in which we have been influenced, and therefore don't have much self-consciousness, and are liable then to be influenced by ideas and practices that maybe we shouldn't be influenced by.
Well, what if I haven't encountered many of the people you assign to read in your classes? I just read my Bible. I'm not influenced, I'm not shaped by those people you're talking about. Why do I need to know who they are, what happened, how these interpretations of Scripture emerged in the past?
Well, because all of us, when we come to read the Bible by ourselves or in a study group, are carrying with us approaches to the Bible, ideas about the Bible that have been developed in the history of the church. And if we're not aware of some of that, we're not very likely to come to any different conclusion than the conclusions we've been shaped by when we come to the Bible. I see this and marvel at it. I'm sure you've seen it more than I have, over and over again, of people who say they were in the church all their life, they studied the Bible, they read the Bible, they heard the Bible preached, and they never heard about predestination. Mm-hmm. And then they discover the Reformed faith, they go back and read the Bible and say, how can I have missed all of this all these years? And it's because we come with a certain mental set, and that set is difficult to challenge if people don't know anything about church history.
So we read the Bible together with some group that has been shaped and influenced by what has gone before.
Exactly. Exactly.
So we at least should know what those influences are that are shaping our reading of Scripture.
Right.
What is a danger in approaching church history? There are some people who like church history because they think of a golden age. There was this time of the, if we could only get back to the apostolic church, or if only we could get back to the church of the fathers, the post-apostolic church fathers, because they were in direct connection with the apostolic era, or if only we could get back to Christendom when there was one united church and culture, or it's the Reformation, or it's the Puritans. You know, we all have these periods that we think were the high point, and then everything before and after it is decline. What's wrong with that approach? And how does actually studying church history deprive us of that convenient way of looking at it?
It's a great question, because I think we're all drawn to the notion that wouldn't it be wonderful to rediscover some idealized past, and then if we could only replicate it in the present, everything would be grand. And I don't want to deny that there are periods in the history of the church that are better than other periods, but there never was a golden age in the sense that everything was perfect. And the best way to recognize that is to read the New Testament. If there ever would have been a golden age, you'd think it would be in the time of the apostles, who could speak authoritatively for Christ to the church. And yet, when you read 1 Corinthians, you realize, and 2 Corinthians, you realize what a struggle, nonstop struggle, Paul had to try to keep the churches in any kind of order. And that's true everywhere. Calvin, as you remember at the beginning of his commentary on Zephaniah, wants to deny passionately that he lives in a golden age. He knows how great the struggles were, how difficult the times were. So we can appropriately say, well, the Lord seemed to do extraordinary things through Calvin and Luther, through other great teachers. But we always have to remember that those things happened in the midst of great struggle and difficulty. And there are things we can learn from almost every age of the church, things to emulate and things to avoid. But never was there an idealized time when everything was great.
There are a lot of Protestants today who sort of romanticize the ancient church. If we could only get back to the age of the fathers, or the patristic age. How do you respond to that? Was there one monolithic patristic age? And should we assume that all of the church fathers understood perfectly well, more than we could, what the New Testament was teaching?
You know, I guess the mean-spirited part of me, which is just a tiny, tiny part, but the mean-spirited part of me wants to say to a lot of these people, how many of the church fathers have you actually read? Because I think what is sort of shocking about the church fathers, particularly the earlier you go, is how rather naive and lacking in insight an awful lot of what they wrote was. And when we think of the patristic period, if we think of it, say, from about 100 to 500, there were some wonderful things that happened in that period. Great missionary work, great devotion, great struggling with fundamental issues like the canon of Scripture and the divinity of Christ and the nature of the Trinity. And we should hold those who labored in those areas up to real praise and appreciation. But there was also a great deal of confusion in the patristic period. And although you can look to Augustine as a great light in terms of an understanding of grace in many ways, there are many fathers that have a decidedly moralistic overcast to what they're saying. It just shows, again, it's not a golden age. There are very strong things that happen, but also a developing pattern as the period goes on of increasingly problematic approaches to church, to ministry, to sacraments, to personal devotion. And so that's why, although we don't believe you can read the Bible separated from the history of the church, we do believe passionately the Bible always stands as judge of the history of the church and the work of the church. So that biblical standard has to be held up against the patristic period as well as any other period.
Isn't it interesting, too, how much disagreement and even schism, division, there was? We imagine that this was a monolithic, you know, everybody got together in blissful fraternity, and in actual fact, a lot of the great truths that we affirm that did come out of this wonderful period, it was hammered out on the anvil of great difficulty and controversy.
Absolutely. I mean, Athanasius, as Bishop of Alexandria that we treasure today as a champion of orthodoxy, he was exiled 5 times from his see. John Chrysostom, many have argued the greatest preacher in the history of the church in terms of ability as a communicator, and in many places a defender of orthodoxy. He died in exile, driven from his see. So it was a period of a great deal of debate and of division, and certain people who want to stress the authority of the tradition of the church want to go back and tidy all that up and have a clear dividing line of who are the good guys and who are the bad guys, who are the schismatics and who are the Catholics with a small c. And most of the time, it's not quite that neat and tidy to be able to do that.
So once again, history both shows us the feet of clay that we've always had as pilgrims in this age, but also the enormous faithfulness of God to preserve his church through all periods as well.
Right, right. And that's why the greatest of the saints also had to be justified by faith alone, because their works were not adequate to earn them a way into heaven.
Mm. Talk to us a little bit about the problem of Gnosticism. This is something that almost completely swept the church into oblivion. What is Gnosticism?
The biggest problem with Gnosticism is learning how to spell it, and many students have really not risen to that level of achievement.
It's Gnosticism, right?
It's Gnosticism, and of course it's derived from the Greek word for knowing, and the essence of Gnosticism was a conviction that people needed to know, and often could know only by secret knowledge that Gnostic teachers could be paid to give them.
Not the knowledge that was passed down from the apostles.
Right. Or if the claim was made, it was that there were secret knowledge passed down by the apostles that wasn't given to the church generally.
Unwritten traditions?
Yes. And the idea was that if you were initiated into the secret knowledge, then you would understand more about the transcendence of God, and you'd be able to connect better with this transcendent God. So it was a form of Neoplatonism, in a sense, hyper-spirituality, ahistorical, really running against most of the deeply seated convictions of the New Testament about the importance of history, mm-hmm. about the importance of the incarnation, the importance of the crucifixion and resurrection. So it was a hyper-spiritualizing form of Christianity that, yeah, nearly destroyed the church by its emphases.
When you talk about Gnosticism and define it in that way, it brings up another question of how our philosophical prejudices shape our interpretation of Scripture. Here's Gnosticism, an attempt to translate, not just to make it more understandable, but to actually radically alter its basic teaching to make it more accommodating to secular Greek minds. Is that something that church history also teaches us as a perennial danger?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we are, as human beings, inevitably a part of our culture. We can't escape that. Nobody can sort of stand above and be independent of their culture. But the study of history is one way in which we can be sensitized to the ways in which we've been influenced by our culture. You know, it's interesting how that works out. I think you could argue that Christian Science, for example, is a kind of modern manifestation of Gnostic points of view. And even though Christian Science didn't attract huge numbers of people, it continues to attract some people. So hyper-spirituality in various manifestations through the whole history of the church does attract a certain following. Some eras of the church, it will attract many more people than other eras, depending on the culture that surrounds it. But there are also perennial aspects of this that attract certain kinds of people.
So there's nothing really new under the sun.
There's nothing really new under the sun. That's so true. Somebody should write that down as a quotation.
That would be a very good one.
Market it, yes.
Some early fathers will comment on a biblical text as if the surface meaning, the kind of meaning that you would give to any normal text, especially a historical narrative, a report, is just the husk that you have to open up in order to get to the real kernel of truth, which is allegorical and spiritual. The ascent of Moses up the mountain isn't just Moses going up the mountain. It's an allegory of the ascent of the soul. What effect did allegory have, and how, in some ways, are churches today repeating that allegorical method? Is this something that is a perennial influence?
I think it is. I think sometimes before we attack the allegorical approach, we have to appreciate what motivated it. The motivation was to make all the scriptures rather immediately relevant and helpful to the Christian. If I read that Moses went up the mountain, it's not immediately spiritually edifying and profitable to me. It's a historical fact. And, you know, if we're honest, we've all read parts of the Old Testament where the question arises, why is this there? What is the value of it? And the allegorical interpretation is a sort of short-circuiting of figuring out how this is relevant and spiritually profitable for me. And we may not see it always done in quite the form it was done in the ancient and medieval churches, but it definitely takes place today. And I think in evangelical Protestant circles, where it's particularly done is lifting a verse out of context and then treating that verse as if it's sort of a self-contained spiritual truth that doesn't have to be related to what comes before it and what comes after it. And one example of that, I think, is in many of the health and wealth gospel movements. They can come up with verses. The question is, are they really faithfully interpreting those verses, or have they lifted them entirely out of the context of the New Testament, Old Testament, wherever they come from?
Mm. How did the early church get to the place where it answered, as we would answer today, the question Jesus posed to Peter, "Who do men say that I am?" A lot of people today will say that basically it was the Emperor Constantine. After he was converted, he twisted everybody's arm politically. He basically took over the church, and he called this Nicene Council. And what we have as a result is a powerful monarch imposing his will, marginalizing the voices that said otherwise. And you hear this not only from Mormons in criticizing the doctrine of the Trinity and Arians like the Jehovah's Witnesses, but also from the Dan Browns and the Elaine Pagels, you know, around the Harvard Divinity School halls. So how do you respond to that as a historian?
Well, it's a great question. It's a big question. What we see is that Christianity today, as frequently in the history of the church, is being attacked by people who reject what Christianity stands for. And whether it's the Arians that you mentioned, or the anti-Trinitarians, or simply the sort of skeptical liberals, we are experiencing today what many of the fathers experienced in the patristic period. The truth is under attack, and we shouldn't be overly surprised by that, but neither should we be discouraged or dismayed by it. And I think the crucial thing is, when we take a great confessional statement of the church like the Nicene Creed, which did happen at a council, or was written at a council that the Emperor Constantine called, we need to take that creed and then go back to the New Testament and say, does this creed accurately reflect what the New Testament in fact says? And although there may be some technical terms that you find in the creed that you don't find in the New Testament, in fact, the substance of the doctrine, the character of the doctrine, you do find in the New Testament. And, you know, even the critics, when pressed, have to acknowledge that, because then very quickly they say, oh, well, you're quoting the Gospel of John. That's not really expressing the original message of Christianity. So now they have to cut things out of the New Testament to continue to prove their case that these things weren't taught in the New Testament. And so you really get this amazing reductionism that at a certain point you want to say is just silly, except the attack is too important to be let go by just saying it's silly. But it is silly as well as really dangerous.
In view of all of that, do you think that in retrospect, Constantine's role in church and state was a good thing or a bad thing for the church?
Well, I think the first thing to be said is that Constantine's role was an inevitable thing. I don't think many in the ancient world had a category for having an emperor and a state that was a-religious or tolerant of all religions. Rome had always had an established religion, and it was almost inevitable that if the emperor was converted, and the course of history seemed to be that eventually an emperor would be converted, that he would eventually move to see his faith become the faith of the empire. Constantine personally didn't do that, although he helped the church in a variety of ways. I think the Christianizing of the West and the support that the state came to give to the church in the West, in the long run, had good and bad aspects to it. And it's fine to debate that and to talk about it. And it's certainly one of the characteristics of the church today that we have by and large moved beyond that period of history where we could expect state help and support. And in some ways, I think you can say that church is healthier for that. But nonetheless, there were some good things in that period. So
that's where history
comes
in again.
It was no golden age. Yeah, it was no golden age. But it was an age of good things as well as problematic things.
Isn't that one of the real benefits of history, that you are disabused of both the romantic view of the past and also disabused of sweeping generalizations, sweeping dismissals of periods and individuals and contributions? That history is sort of like, our own personal lives pretty messy.
It is. And yeah, I think that's exactly right. And just as we have in the decisions we make individually various motives that come to play, so in the history of the church, you find that multiplicity of motives. And people say, well, Constantine can't have been sincere in his support of Christianity because it also did him some political good. Well, those two things aren't necessarily contradictory. We too sometimes make decisions not on just purely spiritual motives, but profit in other ways from it as well.
Who was Augustine?
Augustine was a man who was named by his mother Augustine, but sort of effete British people continue to refer to him as Augustine.
Since Augustine is a city in Florida?
Yeah, that's the old joke, isn't it? St. Augustine is in heaven and St. Augustine is in Florida. But since the Latin is Augustinus, it's a little hard to figure out why he can't be Augustine. More importantly, however, he was a brilliant theologian, a brilliant preacher, a brilliant pastor, and left some really precious writings to the church as he wrestled personally with the problem of sin and as he wrestled with the question of how one should understand the grace of God operating to save sinners. And so his personal work, Confessions, has sometimes been called the first introspective work in Western civilization, and certainly is a work of literary and poetic genius as well as deep theological insight into how God had pursued him and turned him. So he is probably the greatest of the Western church fathers and a very profound thinker about grace.
What was the context of The City of God? Why did he write that classic?
Well, formally, he writes it in response to the sacking of the city of Rome by Alaric in 410. But it's a bigger project to think about, as some people have said, a theology of history. What is God doing in history? Where is history going? And his great point there is to say that all of history is an interaction of the city of God, the people of God, whom God is redeeming and building, and the city of this world, which stands in opposition to God. And these cities have different origins, they have different ends, and they have different means of building in history. And he's trying to help Christians understand that. It's a kind of, in part, a theology of culture that he's writing. Mm. A powerful work influencing the development of Western thinking.
How about the controversy between Augustine and Pelagius?
How about it? It's, again, one of the really important controversies in the history of the church. Pelagius's point of view was basically, we can become right with God apart from grace if we work hard enough at it. And isn't God nice to have given us grace to help us because we're kind of weak and negligent? But grace is not essential. The freedom of the will is essential. And Augustine responded to that very powerfully in insisting that grace is absolutely necessary for people to be restored to God. And so began a discussion that I think one could say only comes to full fruition with the Reformation, where the Reformation makes clear, where Augustine perhaps didn't, exactly the relationship of faith to grace. But he was a clear teacher of the necessity of grace and the sovereignty of grace in salvation.
Doesn't this remind us of the debt we have to heretics? Because in each of these great consensus-making creeds and conclusions about matters that had been sort of left a little bit murky, it is because the heretics provoked the pastors of the church to come together and really wrestle with the scriptures teaching on these points, that we actually have an emerging consensus that we benefit from. We're not going back and doing all of the legwork on the Trinity and the two natures of Christ in one person and the doctrine of grace. We at least have somewhere to begin because of their great reflections. Isn't heresy historically an important provocation for that?
Well, it seems to me you're a lot softer on heretics than I would want to be, but I think it is true that...
We should award them anything, but...
In the face of error, the church has certainly often come to a much clearer, more helpful statement about the truth. But I think we ought to give the credit to those who are answering the heretics. But it is true that sometimes the church has not thought carefully enough about a subject until it suddenly finds the truth that in an inchoate way it had been affirming attacked, and then with greater clarity has to come to answer the question. The church had always said Jesus was the Son of God, but only in the face of Arius did it have to try to come to a much greater clarity with what exactly do we mean by that expression, mm-hmm. Son of God.
With the enthronement of Pope Francis, we heard, and we heard before that with Pope Benedict, throughout the media, just the basic assumption that there has been this continuous line of popes for 2,000 years. It's remarkable how much is questioned concerning the eyewitness reports of the evangelists to Jesus Christ, and yet it's just taken for granted that what Rome claims about the papacy is accurate. Can you give us a little thumbnail sketch on how to think about the rise of the papacy?
Well, let me just say in the first place that what you see characteristically in the media is people report on religion who don't know anything about religion and aren't really interested in religion. And so what they do is they bring in an expert to comment, and whenever anything Roman Catholic is taking place, they bring in a Roman Catholic to comment who gives the party line, if that doesn't sound too harsh. So I think what's interesting when you study the history of the church is that, first of all, pretty early on, first 100, 150 years, you do see the emergence far and wide of bishops leading the church locally. Now, that word bishop, though, needs to be understood in context of the ancient church. Those bishops really are much more like what we would call today senior pastors of large congregations. They're preachers. They're shepherds. They're active. They're not CEO administrators at some distance. They are active pastors working in churches. And then as churches sought to face problems and to coordinate their actions and to ensure that they were all teaching and believing the same things, there began to emerge certain regional bishops that became sources of appeal, sources of help to other bishops.
More senior pastor than most senior pastors.
Well, yeah. and then in the East, there emerged three or four of these very senior pastors, became known as patriarchs in the church, to whom appeal could be made, help could be received from. And in the West, there was only one, the Bishop of Rome, who emerged as a patriarch. But I think in the actual history of the thing, Rome and Constantinople, Alexandria, Antioch, Jerusalem, these patriarchs emerged as courts of appeal. So the authority that was over many several centuries vested in these bishops came from the bottom up. And then what Rome has done is turned history on its head and said that all authority comes from Christ to the Bishop of Rome and then passes down to the churches. So that's the great argument of the papacy. If you're not in fellowship with Rome, you're not in fellowship with Christ. And he intended authority and power to flow from the top down into the church.
And what you're saying here is not just a Protestant critique or a Protestant interpretation of the history. The Christian East would make the same argument.
Significantly the same argument. Most contemporary Roman Catholic historians would agree with what I've said as a historical fact, even though they might want to put a different theological spin on it. This is fairly standard, and that's why it's important that we really see that Eastern Orthodoxy, if we're talking about which is the original church, which is the oldest church, Eastern Orthodoxy has a better claim on that title than the Roman Catholic Church. Now, we wouldn't agree with Eastern Orthodoxy in all of its claims either, but it's really Rome that ultimately tried to assert its authority over all churches, that the Eastern churches, being older than the Roman Church, or at least as old as the Roman Church, said, now, wait a minute. This is not the way we have ever understood the church or understood the authority of the Bishop of Rome.
And didn't that lead to the division between the Christian East and the Christian West?
It did. It did. A division that was, you know, in part precipitated by other historical factors, but was finally sealed by this insistence of Rome for its own authority, an authority not recognized in the ecumenical councils of the church.
How significant, then, when we get into the Reformation era, how significant is it that the reformers are able to look back to this history that you're describing and say, look, we're not trying to start something new. We're trying to go back to the place before the arrogant assertion of papal power in the medieval era.
Exactly. It was very important. The Reformation in the timing of God takes place after the recovery of an ability to read many Greek sources that were not easily read before in the West, and showed this existence and history of the church in a very different way than Rome had argued it. So that was a significant impact on the Reformers. Again, the Reformers didn't see the ancient church as a golden age, but they did see it as an age with a certain purity greater than what had developed in the medieval West.
One of the things, as we now are talking about the Reformation, one of the things that strikes me is how much Calvin, for example, but not only Calvin, all of his fellow Reformers, not only appealed to the ancient church and, as Calvin himself put it, the better medieval scholastic theologians, but actually could outquote Roman Catholic opponents in debates. So here's a real sense of being embedded in history, taking history very seriously, and knowing what the history says as a powerful corrective for where the church was in that particular time and place. Isn't that different from the picture a lot of people have of the Reformers as almost proto-Enlightenment people who were wanting to reboot and start Christianity all over again?
Oh, absolutely. They were not Latter-day Saints. They were not people who thought the church had died out and now needed to be reconstituted by them. They wanted to reform the church. The church was there, but there were all sorts of corruptions in the church that needed to be addressed and changed. And for that process, they found the history of the church very profitable. Of course, the New Testament, the Old Testament were the authorities that all things needed to be judged by for the Reformers. But the history of the church, again, liberated them to see certain claims made by Rome as completely untrue. You may have read the recent book by Gary Wills, Why Priests? Mm. Here's a Roman Catholic layman, to be sure, a kind of controversial Roman Catholic layman, who's gone back and read the New Testament. He says, I'm amazed there's nothing about priests in the New Testament, and there's nothing about Eucharistic sacrifice in the New Testament. And all I've been taught about the very centrality of Eucharistic sacrifice offered by priests in the Roman Catholic Church all my life seems not substantiated by the New Testament. And it's an almost 16th century Reformation moment that has just kind of been ignored by Roman Catholics generally with this book out there. I wondered if this book would be a bombshell, but no, they are so accustomed now to the notion that tradition has evolved beyond the New Testament, that they're not even embarrassed that there's not much New Testament foundation or any New Testament foundation what they're saying. In the 16th century, lots of them were embarrassed. They worked very hard to try to show that their religion had a root in the New Testament. But so in some ways, you could say Roman Catholicism is worse today than it was then.
Because doctrinal development basically means what the church says today can trump what the church has said in the past.
Right, right.
It's trying to do too much here, I realize, to reduce it in this way, but could you summarize the concern of the Reformation in 3 points? What would have been the 3 major issues that provoked the Reformation?
Well, the first would have been the question of authority. How do we know what's true? And I think not only those who became major reformers, but many other scholars, including someone like Erasmus, were deeply troubled to recognize that what they read in the New Testament was so very different from what they experienced in the church. Erasmus was troubled by the moral corruption and the empty ceremonialism that for him just seemed so contrary to New Testament religion. So the question of authority was absolutely fundamental. Secondly, obviously, the doctrine of salvation, the doctrine of justification in particular, how are we right with God? Can we know we're right with God? Can we have confidence in God? That was a crucial question coming to people filled with anxiety and from a church that promoted anxiety as spiritually beneficial. And then thirdly, I think, the matter of worship. One of the huge teachings of the Old Testament is God cares about the way in which he's worshiped. And God has acted to tell us how he wants to be worshiped. And the church is extraordinarily foolish to ignore what God has said about worship.
On the question of Scripture, the Roman Church argued then and still today that once you open the door with this idea of sola scriptura, Scripture alone being the ultimate norm of our faith and practice, the door is wide open for countless sects, because basically what you're saying is we have an infallible text, but there is no infallible teacher, and therefore everybody does what is right in his own eyes because there was no king in Israel. How do we respond to that when it's manifestly obvious that Protestantism, just look at the yellow pages under churches, Protestantism is a bewildering chaos of denominations?
That's perfectly true. And if the Pope had successfully been a teacher of a single unifying truth in the Roman Catholic Church, that apologetic critique of Protestantism would be much more worrying and telling. In point of fact, the range of theological opinion in the Roman Catholic Church is just about as broad as the range of opinion in the Protestant churches. So,
just held together by that one dogma of implicit faith in whatever the church embodied in the Pope teaches.
Well, in fact, not even held together by that. I mean, there are many people who criticize the Pope, who debate every issue that comes along as to whether it's actually an infallible teaching or not. There's just an incredible range of opinion. What really holds Rome together is a certain measure of liturgical uniformity, so that in every Roman Catholic church there is a priest, there is an altar, there is a measure of cohesion of words spoken at the altar. But what those words mean, what the actions mean, the range of opinion about that is incredibly broad. So the notion that Rome has prevented doctrinal fragmentation is just false. On the other hand, I think we could say that amongst genuinely Bible-believing Christians, there is an awful lot of uniformity about Trinity, about incarnation, about grace. I think when you look back at the 16th and 17th century, it's amazing that with such huge level of agreement, you could produce, say, the Westminster Confession of Faith and the Lutheran dogmatic standards. And while there are differences, there's a huge level of agreement across those documents. So there's not perfect uniformity, but if we can make a virtue out of a problem the way you tried to do with heresy, we could say that the very disagreements drive us back to the Bible and to continued reflection and questioning. What does the Bible really say? The biggest problem, it seems to me, Protestantism has today is the number of Protestants who don't go back to the Bible, who really kind of use the Bible as best as a kind of poetic inspiration, and they go leaping off with ideas that they don't really feel the obligation to spend a great deal of time proving out of Scripture.
So Protestantism to a lot of people in the West today basically means think for yourself, no authority, whether the church or Scripture.
Right. And that is not what Protestantism meant in the 16th century or what really should be called Protestantism today.
When it comes to the question of justification, which Calvin called the chief controversy between us and Rome, where are we today? A lot of evangelicals say, well, the Reformation's over. We're no longer, especially after Vatican II and subsequent ecumenical conversations, especially the Lutheran World Federation's agreement with the Vatican, that there's now a joint understanding of justification. Why are we still protesting? What, there's no reason to be a Protestant anymore. What do you say to people like that?
I would say in a lot of hearts, the Reformation does appear to be over, because a lot of people who still think of themselves as Protestants have in fact agreed with Rome that the great issue is always morality. How are you doing morally? And as a certain number of Protestants see the moral decline of the West and the disestablishment of longstanding Christian moral values from authority in our culture, in a sort of cultural panic, they see Rome as a sort of bulwark for moral cultural standards. And we can be thankful that on certain issues, Rome is a bulwark on certain moral issues. But that legitimate concern about culture mustn't change the way we think about the gospel. Whether American culture, Western culture survives or doesn't survive, whether it sinks in an immoral abyss or whether it is rejuvenated in some moral fashion, the great question of how you're right with God does not rest on those sorts of cultural questions.
And we still disagree today as you look at the so-called agreements?
Absolutely. In as I read those agreements, and I'm only one person, but as I read those agreements in light of the history of the church, those agreements all rest on concessions Protestants offer to Rome, not concessions Rome offers to Protestants. Protestants sometimes think they've gained concessions because they really don't know enough of church history to know what Rome has always said. But certainly in the various recent claims of some progress on defining this matter of justification, in point of fact, it is the Protestants who've conceded and Rome has not conceded at any vital point. So I would say the great concern of the Reformation about justification is as vital, as needed, as crucial today as it's ever been, and that it's not just Rome that gets that wrong, but many Protestants get it wrong.
Dr. Godfrey, thank you for sharing your thoughts on the importance of church history and submitting to this rapid-fire set of questions on various periods in church history. It's always a pleasure.
It's fun to be here, and I hope this has the effect of whetting interest in church history and leading people to want to study more.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. To find out how to support our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also check out the support tab of our website at whitehorsein.org. That's whitehorsein.org.